Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week's podcast comes live from my BFI MK3D show at the South Bank in London. And it was a guest-packed Christmas special with guests including Gwenno Saunders, the brilliant musician, Emily Beecham, who won a Best Actress Award for her performance in Little Joe at the Cannes Film Festival, and starting off with the great Taron Egerton.
Good evening, everybody. Lovely to see you all here. You know, I've never... Do you always clap when I come on? I've never noticed you doing that before. You know you literally don't have to, because it's like everyone else, it's polite, but you're here anyway, okay? So, welcome to this. This, unbelievably, is the last show of the fourth year that we have been doing this thing. So... due to a sort of weird mathematical anomaly... our 50th show is actually March, so we're going to have a big sort of 50th show ding-dong. I have now officially outlasted Celine Dion in Las Vegas, and I would like... We've got loads of fabulous stuff for you. Because it's the Christmas show, we're going to be kind of sprinkling Christmassy stuff all the way through it. There will be a musical element, which you probably guessed... I kind of realised when I walked on that that's blown at least one of the gags. But we'll start, as ever, since a lot happened since I last saw you. We'll do a quick ask the audience. If anybody has anything they would like to ask, stick your hand up and we'll just leap straight in. I'm going to have to just do that in front of the lights. Anybody have anything that they want to raise, or are we all just in shock? Yes.
Hi.
Hello. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas to you. Is there a remake from Spielberg about West Side Story? Anything to fill us in on that?
Well, it is coming. I mean, I think it's all done as far as we understand. There have been certain changes to certain songs, but it is definitely... I mean, I'm a huge fan of the original West Side Story anyway. Yeah. And who knows? I mean, it never occurred to me when I saw the original, wow, that really needs updating. But, it's Spielberg. I never thought that Wages of Fear needs updating, and then, you know, Friedkin made Sorcerer. I always thought that Abu Dissouf was a bit pants, and then Richard Gere made Breathless. So it's fabulous, you know, swings and roundabouts. So are you looking forward to it?
Yes, yeah, very much.
But it's not, we haven't got it for a while, and, you know, we'll wait and see. He hasn't finished it yet. Then again, last I looked, Tom Hooper hadn't finished Cats, and it's premiering New York tonight. So there we go. Anyone else? Yes, at the back there, sir.
Hi, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
I was just wondering, would you ever get Jane Hill to watch a horror movie, and what would it be?
You know, weirdly enough, I did try to do... I mean, Jane is brilliant, but she's not a horror fan. And so the last DVD recommendation we did, I recommended Annabelle Comes Home on the basis that it's not very scary. I mean, it is technically a horror movie, but it's not very scary. I've actually, because she said to me, what can I watch that wouldn't be too scary, but would be good? And the thing I suggested, although I'm now kind of slightly regretting this, is I suggested Onibaba, the Japanese movie, right? Well, yeah, I know, but Onibaba is like a PG certificate. It's the scariest hell. It's like terrifying. And I said to her, oh, you'll be fine with that. And then I was thinking about it, thinking, actually, no, that's a really, really scary film. What would you suggest that's a horror film that's good but isn't scary? And there we go. You see? And there's my dilemma. Okay, let's do one more. Yes, there. You're wearing a Christmas jumper. That's fantastic. Round of applause for the first Christmas jumper of the season.
Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Not referring to anyone or anything in particular. I just want to know, are things going to be all right in the end?
I'm going to reiterate exactly what I said on Thursday. We did the radio show that we usually do on Friday. We did it on Thursday because when election day happens, you can only have non-political stuff on. So they moved the radio show that Simon and I do to Thursday because on Friday it was all, you know, fallout from the election. Still can't say it. From the election. And somebody asked me exactly the same question. And this is what I said, and I promise you I hadn't planned this. This is what I said, but thinking about it, I think it was actually a perfectly good answer. At least it's the best answer I have. And it's this. It's The Exorcist. And it's the scene when Karis is in the bar with Tom Birmingham after his mother has died. And he says, I need reassignment. I'm unfit. And Tom Birmingham says, and I met obviously both Jason Miller and Tom, and I went to the bar because I'm obsessive. And Tom Birmingham says, you know, but you're the best we've got. And Karis says, am I? Really? He says, some of their problems, they're more than psychiatry. They come down to faith, their vocation, the meaning of their lives, and I can't cut it anymore. And then he pauses and then he goes, I think I've lost my faith. And I then said, and the whole of the rest of the movie is him regaining his faith through facing the most unbelievable evil. And right now, I am Karis in that bar. And I was able to do that on election day without breaking any BBC rules. So thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, we have a whole bunch of guests for you, and I want to get things started. This is very exciting. Last month, Dexter Fletcher came on because I was talking about Rocket Man, which, as you all know, I love. I've just finished doing my sort of, you know, top 10 of the year list, and of course, Rocket Man features very heavily. Let me show you the trailer for Rocket Man because I've been thinking about it a lot as the end of the year comes around again. This is the trailer for the fabulous Rocket Man.
How much pressure I am under?
Not really. I'll still be collecting my 20% long after you've killed yourself.
Maybe I should have tried to be more ordinary.
You were never ordinary.
Little boy, you
man.
Look at you now.
So at the end of the interview, Dexter Fletcher said, you should get Taron Egerton on. So we did. Ladies and gentlemen, Taron Egerton.
Thank you. I can't tell you how excited I am to have you on the show. And I'm going to be like a little, like this. So... absolutely love the film. I suppose the most important thing is, at what point did you know that you had been cast in that role? Because you embody it so brilliantly, and you do all your own singing, and it's something that, you know, it starts with him in rehab looking back at his life. So it's a crazy period. It's like a kind of Ken Russell extravaganza. At what point did you know that you were to play Elton?
It was quite a gradual conversation that started in 2016. Elton played a sort of cameo guest role in Matthew's sequel to the Kingsman film.
It's the longest cameo I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
The cameo goes all the way through the film.
Exactly, yeah. Actually, I just want to say before we get into all this that the feeling is entirely mutual. And when this movie came out, your opinion was the one that I was waiting for.
Oh.
And it was, and I'm a great admirer of your considered nature and your lucidity and your thoughtfulness. And it was a great patronage for us. So thank you.
I think you're thinking of Mark Cousins. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Matthew first asked me about it then, and Dexter and I had made this movie called Eddie the Eagle that we'd had a really, really good time making and we're very proud of. And it just felt very right. And I suppose in some respects as well, it felt like a kind of watershed moment for me as an actor, because I've had some incredible opportunities in my 20s, but I was kind of yearning for something that I could expand into a little more, and this was that. It was such a great part on the page.
Were you always an Elton fan?
Yes.
I'm saying Elton like I know him. Were you always an Elton John fan?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always been a real music fan, and I remember, you know, he had a Greatest Hits album that came out in 2002, and that's when I really first got into him. And I actually sang your song for my... I went to RADA in London, and your song was one of my audition pieces. And that was when I was about 17, 18, yeah. So he's been there a lot, yeah. And
what's your favourite Elton album? And instantly there is a correct answer to this, so tread very carefully.
It's Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Gang.
Yes!
Yeah.
It's because there is a correct answer. Oh, I'm so pleased.
Well, it's the right answer,
yeah,
Mark.
It is the right answer. You can all go home. We're fine. Okay, so what's the immediate challenge? Somebody says, okay, you're going to play this role, and it's, I mean, like you say, it's the step up to the Mark role because there's so much involved in it. What's the most challenging thing about it? What's the thing that makes you go,
I mean, I think he's so many he is so many things, you know. He's at one moment incredibly vulnerable and sort of boyish and childlike, and the next he can be this kind of titanic force of nature and be someone quite intimidating. And I wanted to do justice to that. And I suppose the singing as well. The singing is the first thing that springs to mind because it's a musical, obviously, and so it's a prerequisite that I
be. Have you always been a singer?
Yeah, a bit. I mean, I was raised in Wales, so it's part of the culture. And yeah, as I say, you know, I've always been a big music fan, and I've always played music at every available moment. And at some point, I started singing along, but I don't have any kind of formal training, really, other than, you know, basic singing lessons at drama school and stuff.
And it was always the case that the lead role was going to sing the song, because obviously we've seen you know, musicals in which that doesn't happen. You segue into somebody else's, but it's you that we hear. And I have to say, I mean, I think it's important because I think that continuation of voice from the speaking voice to the singing, you couldn't have broken it.
Well, in musicals, you know, the songs are soliloquies. You're expressing something that words have become too pedestrian for, you know. So for me, the idea that I don't sing it would just be really weird, you know. It doesn't make sense to me. And where possible, we sang live to give it that authenticity and immediacy. So your song is all recorded live on set, and I bloody loved every minute of it. I really did.
I want to show a clip of Elton John's first, well, one of his first meetings with Bernie Taupin, because obviously their relationship, which is so central to Captain Fantastic, which is why I'm so glad you chose that. And so this is really, so tell us about who's playing Bernie Taupin.
So Bernie Taupin is played by the wonderful Jamie Bell. And I remember very early on in the process, there were lots of names thrown around, and it was just one day Dexter came up to me with this big grin on his face and said, "We've nailed it." And I said, "Who is it?" And he went, "It's going to be Jamie Bell." And it's just like, thank God, because it is so central. It's the central platonic love story of the movie. And, you know, "Someone Saved My Life Tonight" is my favourite song. And it's so about, it's Bernie writing, it's Elton performing with words that Bernie has written about Elton. And you know, they're two sides of one coin creatively, but Elton said, you know, that he's the brother I never had. When I first asked him, you know, what was it like when you met Bernie? He said, "I just had someone to go to the cinema with, you know." And I love how kind of gorgeously low-key that is. And that's the sort of, we wanted the friendship to feel really honest and open, but also kind of emotionally articulate. We wanted to, you know, a platonic male friendship that isn't, we didn't want them to be bros, do you know what I mean? You know, Jamie was the perfect scene partner.
Okay, let's have a look.
Bernie Taupin.
Yeah, you must be Elton?
Yeah.
Hi.
Well, that's my stage name.
Oh. Well, you can tell me your real name when we get to know each other better.
Right.
See you.
I like your lyrics.
Thank you. Yeah, I got the tape that you sent. It's great. Really good.
Thanks.
Oh, hang on. Hey, don't bother with that one. That wasn't supposed to be in there.
No, that's really good. I wrote a tune to it.
Yeah, I bought a song.
Yeah. I read it and I could hear the whole tune in my head. It was all there, I could see all the notes, and I just had to get it out. It's like my fingers couldn't work fast enough to keep up with my brain. Do you ever get anything like that?
Not really, no. I can write more for you, though, Elton. I'll just send them down to you.
Great.
What I love about that scene, actually, this kind of continues throughout the whole film, is that they mutually admire each other. There's this kind of slight distance, but yeah. they both do something that the other one can't do. Yeah. And Elton John has said many times that when he's writing the songs, he gets the lyrics and he either sits down and writes it or it doesn't happen. That when he writes it, so when there's that scene in which he starts playing your song, he said that literally is how your song came about.
Yeah, he doesn't waste time, and they don't write in the same room. He literally sends in the lyrics, and Elton will go to the piano, and if it's not happening in sort of half an hour, 45 minutes, it's not happening at all.
Did Elton take you under his wing? Because you have to learn his mannerisms. It's your performance, but
it's been a very surreal, odd thing. It's sort of become normalised now, but you know, he has just become a part of my life, and I'm so grateful to him, because I think it's less so, you know, for anyone who's seen the movie, it's not an impression. It's not what we wanted to do with it. It's very me, really. In the hope of it feeling very personal. But what was important was that it all felt very personal. And so the way that he kind of allowed me into his life and this friendship we've formed really fed that and gave it fuel, I think.
You mentioned we were just talking quickly about critics. You saw the Mumsnet review of the...
Was it sort of slightly strangely? Did it have a strange sort of?
What it said was
a sexual.
It was a review on Mumsnet, and I'm probably slightly paraphrasing it, but it basically said, I was feeling really down, and I went to see Rocket Man, and that scene in it, what she said was, if you're a horny old hound dog who's looking for a thrill in the Fanjo, then watch this movie on hard repeat. And Dexter said that you said it was the best review you'd
it's
ever
my favourite
had.
My favourite review, yeah. Yeah, I'll take that, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think I'm blushing.
But the great thing about the movie is that it is, you know, it is frank, and it is, you know, there are other movies that haven't been as frank. And we always knew that was the film it was going to be, because you can't do an anodyne version of the Elton John story.
No, you can't. And I just don't know why you'd want to, you know. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. His Technicolor kind of ups and downs. You know, why would you not want to depict that? Why would you not want to celebrate that? The movie it's not about deification. It's about celebrating a human being in all their gorgeous flaws. You know, and Elton's flaws are really well documented. So there's no point trying to hide from them.
What about the costumes? Because we saw just in that, you know, you're wearing a period costume with the cool jacket and everything. And then the first time we see when you're sitting in, you're dressed as the deep. I mean, the whole thing about Elton John is at one point he's dressed up as a duck. How was wearing the costumes?
Yeah, amazing. Julian Day is an extraordinary, extraordinary man and talent. And just there's a little tidbit about that I always sort of pull out about the costumes to show his attention to detail. So in the second half of that scene, they discover a shared love for country music, and they start singing Marty Robbins, I think it is, and they're talking about cowboys. And later on in the movie, their kind of final or their penultimate scene together, Elton really nearly ruins the friendship by being, you know, he's in the depths of kind of addiction and behaving terribly. And he really nearly pushes Bernie away, but... So it's kind of like, and the camera wraps around in that scene to mimic how we find them in the cafe as a two shot. It wraps around, and so they're kind of in the same iteration, and Julian dressed as both as cowboys. Jamie in that scene towards the end has a bootlace tie and kind of these big black boots, and I'm dressed as a cowboy too. I have this straw hat. And it's a blue two-piece suit with a silver shirt and red slippers. And that's the song that Goodbye Yellow Brick Road comes out of. And the blue of the satin of the suit is for Dorothy's dress. Obviously, ruby red slippers. The straw hat is for the scarecrow. The silver of the shirt is supposed to represent the Tin Man. And then as I leave to chase him, I put on a fur coat for the lion. And it's just a gorgeous thing, you know. It's a gorgeous Easter egg. A gorgeous Easter egg and testament to Julian's attention to detail.
The film was directed by Dexter Fletcher, who, of course, did work with Ken Russell and worked with Derek Jarman beforehand. What's Dexter like to be directed by? I know you'd worked with him beforehand, but, I mean, I think the job he did on it was astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, Dexter is one of my best friends, and, you know, working with him is, you know, he's my, you know, if there's, you know, he's, I don't know, he's, I struggle to put into words really the relationship we have. It's sort of almost like family, and I feel like I'm at my best around him. I feel like he creates an atmosphere of fun. That's not to make it sound light. You know, the movie deals with some dark things, and some days are quite intense, but he creates an atmosphere of lightness and joy where every member of the crew feels valued and part of the team, and it just creates an atmosphere that you look forward to going to work in. We have shared taste, I think, and I don't know. I just feel like we complement each other well creatively. I love working with him, and I really hope it won't be the last time that we have another creative adventure.
I think one of the most remarkable things about him is that he's this. I mean, the attention to detail in Rocket Man is extraordinary. But in person, he seems to be the most shambolic character.
I know.
He looks like Wurzel Gummidge.
I know. It's a great. I know, and he can't take any compliments or praise.
No, not at all.
He can't deal with it.
No.
He's far more interested in making sure everyone else around him feels validated and worthwhile. He's a truly great man.
And what about the other members? I mean, it's a fantastic cast. You've got people like Stephen Graham in there. To take nothing away from you, has what I think is the best line in the movie, which is after he's heard, I think it's your song, and he goes, oh, I'm going to have a massage.
That's it, yeah. It's truly disgusting. we were spoiled with the people who came and played.
But that, I mean, to have an ensemble cast that's that complete, I mean, there isn't a bum note in that entire cast. You must have felt, okay, this is...
Of course, you know, but in all aspects, in all departments, you know, Marcus Rowland's design, Julian Day, Lizzie George, you doing hair and makeup, you know, it's just a stellar team. And then, as you say, you get this great cast, and particularly, you know, being supported by sort of Jamie Bell and Richard Madden as the two other probably, you know, chief roles. It makes you, as the central performer, feel very supported, I suppose, so you can find the freedom to do what you want to do.
Did you have to wear a denture? Because Elton's got a famous gap between his teeth, and you haven't, have you?
No, Dexter and I had a real thing about this early on, because Dexter was absolutely adamant that we not wear fake teeth, because he felt that it was an inhibition, and there's something inherently kind of false about it. And I do agree, but I felt that the teeth were really important, because it's iconic. It's sort of part of his silhouette, and it made me feel different, and that's really exciting as an actor, where you feel a bit different. What we ended up doing, it was my idea actually, we just painted it in.
Is that what
it
is?
Old school. And then I think...
I imagine that Industrial Light and Magic had worked on your...
Well, I think the equivalent... I think there was probably a bit of jiggery-pokery done afterwards, but the basic thing was just a little gap painted in.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, look, I have to ask you, because we're in awards season now. So how important is it that the film is recognised at awards season?
Well, look, you know, if I said not at all, I'd be lying, because, you know, we've been campaigning, trying to remind people, because we came out so early. Look, you know, it's been, regardless, it has been the professional experience of my life. I've loved it, and nothing's going to change that. It did well at the box office,
and it
was received well by people like yourself and...
Mumsnet.
And Mumsnet. And so, you know... It's really important now, and I'm saying this to myself constantly, just to check myself and go, it doesn't actually matter. But you'd be amazed to have from within the industry, it starts to really feel like it does. But look, you know, we've had a couple of nominations at the Globes and the SAG Awards. So, I mean, we already feel validated in that sense. It just would be the cherry on top of the cake, but it's all good.
Yeah. I do want to say, this sounds ridiculous, but I had this whole thing that all awards are basically evil and terrible and wicked until I won a Sonny, and then it became really, really important. And then the next year I didn't. And then I became really kind of embittered by them about it again. So I understand that thing about it's not important, but it is. Yeah. Can you tell us what you're doing? Because you said that you would like to work with Dexter again in the future. What are you working on now? Is that...
I'm not really. It's been a really great thing for me, Rocketman, and has provided me with lots of other opportunities. But I feel really strongly that I don't want to make any more wrong turns with the roles that I pick, and I want a career that's characterized by interesting choices.
Do you think, and I'm not, no names, no pack drills, do you think that there are things that you've done in the past that have been wrong turns?
Look, I mean, I spoke about this recently in the press about something that I'd done, and afterwards I felt really rotten with myself because it's not just about me, it's about the other people who worked on it as well. So I'm not going to speak negatively about things I've done anymore. I don't think it's cool and I really regret doing it. But yes, there are one or two things that I think were ill-advised, but also, you know, I'm a young person and, you know, there's lots of factors in the equation, and I feel like now at 30 I kind of am a little bit more clear about what I want. And
so you now have the ability to step back and say, I'll do the projects that I want to work on.
I've got a mortgage to pay and all that, I'm more certain of what I want, really. But, you know, those great character roles aren't really finding their way to the big screen in the same way that they have in the past, you know. I'm just waiting for one to come along that feels like something that I can be truly excited about. I don't want to do something because I've convinced myself I'm excited about it. That would be wrong, and I don't need to right at this minute, so I'm not going to.
Okay. Last thing, what's your favourite movie of all time?
I'm not really in the business of favourites. It depends where I am and who I'm with.
Off the top of your head. I'm not taking no for an answer, so I've got all night.
Do you know what movie I really love?
Go on.
The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, if you stick around for the rest of the show, you're not going to be disappointed, because it's the show before Christmas and Muppet Christmas Carol is definitely coming up again. Tarrant, listen, I'm so glad you came on the show.
Thank you,
Mark. I loved Rocket Man, and I can't tell you how relieved I was to love it. But I've now seen it three times, and every time I see it, I see more in it. And I think that the real genius of it is that the more you scratch the surface, it's like what you were saying about the costume, when you start thinking all that stuff through. And it could have gone so spectacularly wrong, and I think it went so spectacularly right, and I think an awful lot of that is down to your brilliant performance. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. In the words of Vinnie Jones, it's been emotional. Okay, so we would usually start with a news thing. We didn't, because I wanted to get sort of straight into that. So we'll just catch up on a couple of things in our section, which we call Here's the Thing. As you know, there is a new Star Wars movie coming out, which I haven't seen yet. I'm seeing it in the next couple of days. The only reason I flagged this up is because there's been quite a lot of stuff in the press about saying, oh, it's fantastic, you know, because J.J. Abrams has come back and therefore he's going to rectify everything after everything that happened with the Rian Johnson. I want to be really clear about this. I think The Last Jedi is absolutely brilliant. And in fact, it's one of my favourite Star Wars movies. And I would be perfectly happy if the series... I mean, you know that a whole bunch of fans had felt very, very differently about it. And in fact, weirdly enough, when Rian Johnson made Knives Out, there were still people who were sore about Star Wars having a go at him. I think that that's a great movie. And I hope that the new Star Wars film lives up to it. Bear in mind, we're coming to the end of a cycle. The first cycle of films, the weakest one was the third one. It's, you know, Muppets in Space. The first cycle of films, the third one was kind of maybe the best one, but then it came after Phantom Menace and all that rubbish. So this is going to be really interesting to see whether they can finish the third cycle on the top. Also, since I last saw you, and this is kind of fairly recent, we lost Danny Aiello. And I was just writing recently about the films of Spike Lee, and I'd gone back to watch Do the Right Thing because it was back in cinemas. I think the BFI had done a reissue of it. And so because we've just lost Danny Aiello, I thought we'd just show this classic scene from Do the Right Thing, which is a film which has aged absolutely brilliantly. So here we go.
You're looking for trouble?
Are you a troublemaker? Is that what you are?
You making trouble?
Yeah, I'm a troublemaker. I'm making trouble.
You're a real ball breaker. You're always coming in here looking for trouble, aren't you? Suppose I busted your head, how would you...
Mookie, why don't you get your friend out of here?
What, are you going to kick me out now? Are you going to kick me out, huh?
No, I'm not kicking you out. You're kicking yourself out.
What? Look, what's the brothers up on the wall, you know? Go. Malcolm X, Nelson Mandela, you know, you're Michael Jordan. Tomorrow.
Come on, Mookie, get him out, all right?
I'm trying to get him out. I paid for his life. I know you paid for it. Let's go. Yeah, all right, all right. So you're kicking me out. Beat me in the head and go kick me out, right?
Come on, let's
yeah,
go.
Okay, bet. Yeah, all right. Let's yeah, go. Look, I paid for my. Look, boycott Styles.
Let's go.
Right? Yo, boycott
ass.
Styles.
I got your boycott swinging.
Boycott Styles. Yo, man, I pay. What you laugh for that? Yo, I paid for my slice, man. Yo, man.
It does still look great. If you saw it when it during the re-release, I mean, it was amazing. If you haven't seen it on the big screen, do try and get a chance because it really is fantastic. Now, on to coming attractions. I want to show you a clip from a movie that's coming out here in February. It played at the Cannes Film Festival where it was a prize winner and got fantastic reviews, not least for its brilliant central performance by Emily Beecham. This is a clip from Little Joe, which is a film which is quite hard to describe. It's essentially Day of the Triffids meets Mike Lee, but that doesn't describe it. Here's a clip.
Alice, you have a minute? I just wanted to say that I feel really proud and excited to be working with you.
Don't expect too much.
No, I'm convinced that this plant is going to be a huge success.
If you say so.
Would you, how about a drink after work?
No, I have to run. Could you finish the logbook and double check the timing of the grow lamps? That'd be so nice of you.
Sure.
Gives me a great pleasure to say welcome to the stage, Emily Beecham. Thank you so much. Emily, thank you so much. Lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So I saw the film at Strasbourg when I was on the jury, and it went down really, really well, but it is a very hard film to describe.
Yes.
Do you want to have a better go than Mike Lee meets Day of the Triffids?
I think that was really good.
Oh, good, thank you.
I've never heard it described like that before.
No, I made it up.
It's very good. You want me to describe?
Well, just, I mean, otherwise I can do a version of the story, but how would you characterise it?
Oh, gosh, it is... Well, I was just sitting there and I was thinking how Rocket Man and Little Joe are the most polar opposite films ever. It's like, well, Jessica Hausner is an Austrian director, and she directed films like Lords, and they've got this really specific personality to them. They've got a black humour, and they're very subtle in the acting style, but they're also very, it's like the film is deliberately artificial in many moments, and even with Jessica's directing, I mean, I'm not answering your question, am I? I'm just not being specific.
No, but
it's impossible. It's been the hardest film to talk about ever, actually doing the Q&As in the first... Oh, shit, sorry.
That's fine.
Talking about this film in the Q&As has been such a challenge.
I'll try and do a version just of kind of the setup. Mm. So essentially, it is a story in which scientists have created a plant that is meant to make its carer happy.
Yes.
It is a plant that is meant to be... So there's a kind of opium eaters thing going on in the background.
Would you like the synopsis, then? I'll give you the synopsis.
No, sorry. I was just suggesting just to kind of sort of set up. But that's just the setup of the film. And it then becomes a meditation on something sort of much more complex than that. And you said, of course, Jessica Hausner, who I think I'm right in saying that she describes the film as having a British sensibility. Also, it is a BFI-backed movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well done, BFI. So, science fiction or psychological thriller or what?
Well, Jessica kind of blurs all these subjects together. She's so clever. And so she's got... It's kind of quite... Well, the characters in this Constance becomes extremely paranoid, and she's created, as you said, this plant with a smell that makes the sniffer happy. And they did a lot of research with psychologists and neurologists and plant scientists, and did their research. So they tried to work out if it actually could be real, but it apparently can't. But it couldn't happen. But
then again, I thought that the election could never happen. So you what do I know? You know.
Yeah. Anyway, so this plant has mutated, and they used an unlicensed virus vector, which is a tool that you use to genetically engineer things, and it mutates in order to survive, and emits that scent, and then so it's kind of influenced by Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Jessica's influence was, and so people change, and then in that. My character Alice goes down this rabbit hole, this kind of labyrinth of confusion and paranoia and insecurity and self-consciousness. And then she snaps back into realizing that's all rubbish and quite embarrassed that she lost it a bit. And then back again. So, and Jessica's really cleverly blended the idea of the topic of my character has a teenage son as well who is changing naturally. And her role starts to reverse with him, so she becomes a needy child, kind of insecure, and all her boundaries, everything starts to slip from her, and she becomes insecure. And also in her workplace as well, she's very senior in her workplace, and her work is the only place that she can control, so she loses that also, and loses her.
And one of the things I loved about it is all those things you're describing about her character is actually what happens to the audience. Because I found myself for a good part of the film thinking, I actually don't know whether this is happening.
Yeah.
I don't know whether this is... Because I was, you know, not knowing much about... I mean, I was completely... I think you can read the whole film as if nothing is happening other than what appears to be happening in their minds.
Yeah.
It's very deliberately pitched like that.
Yeah. Jessica says she does that, and she likes people to think it's going to be a thriller or horror, and then she deliberately likes to annoy them and then turn it around so it's not. And she does this thing, which you probably noticed, where she says, usually when the tension builds in a scene, the camera gets closer and closer to the actors' faces and you experience with them. But she says she deliberately liked to miss the moment. So she pans during the scene. She just pans past us really slowly towards the curtain. And that's the scene with Kerry Fox and I. And we're like, we have no idea what this film is going to be, but whatever it is, it's going to be really interesting.
What was it like when it played in Cannes? Because obviously it was very well received.
It was great. That was the first time I'd seen it on the massive screen.
Was it in the Palace?
Yeah.
Fine.
And I think it was the type of film that a Cannes audience would respond to, and they like those interesting films. And so it was great, actually, because it's such a visual film. It's very, really acid colours and an amazing soundtrack.
Oh, the soundtrack is bonkers.
Yes.
But a lot of the soundtrack turns up in the... It's music that's been written for the films of Maya Deren.
That yes. Kind
of, yes, yeah. Which is, and it's quite astonishing to hear it because it's so weird and jarring.
Yeah. And the drum beats go with the eye contact when a thought drops. It goes boom. So it's quite comical.
Yeah. But so tell me about Cannes. I mean, Cannes for me is a bit of a kind of frightening circus. So what was it like being in the middle of all that?
It really is. It was my first experience. And I think throughout my life I've just deliberately kind of ignored, admittedly, award things and ceremonies. So, you know, it's about the work and all that. And I kind of slightly regretted that because I really didn't know what was happening and what was going to happen, and it's so intense, it's so glamorous, but then also, you know, it's got amazing filmmakers and amazing films, so there's all that. And then I think winning it, I woke up in my house after a really long week at Cannes, and I'd already gone back to UK.
Well, you weren't there.
No, I wasn't
you
there.
You won Best Actress at Cannes and you weren't there.
No, I was, but I woke up and I turned on my phone at 10 a.m. and my phone was just buzzing with this with the word can. And then I called the producer and he's like, Emily, where are you? You have to get to the nearest airport. And realised I had to get to Gatwick. And I just caught the last flight that I would have been able to catch, otherwise I wouldn't have gotten there. And so we got on that flight and then... And then they drove me, they picked me up in a car, which also had a motorbike, so that if, and it drove at the most phenomenal speed. I think this guy was a professional hit, like a professional bodyguard driving. He was driving on the wrong side of the road. Me and the producer were like, oh my God. It was just going, and then the motorbike was there to block off traffic. I think it was really illegal. So
this is great.
It was amazing. And then if I was in traffic, I was supposed to hop on the motorbike, you know.
Did that happen?
No, it didn't. I know. And then I just got there on time, and then the publicist, I was in the auditorium, I was sitting there, and the publicist said, so you are winning, so just be prepared. And I was like, oh my God, trying to remember all of the producers' names, and then I realised I never would do that. And so I muttered something about not even packing my toothbrush, which was pitiful, and it was true. And it was all a massive blur. And then,
So from waking up and getting that message to actually being on stage receiving the award was how long?
Oh my God, I don't know. I think it was
6 hours or?
Yeah, and it was so intense.
And you had no idea.
And I had Mads Mikkelsen and Inyo Ritu and Yorgos Lanthimos and all coming up to me, and then people go, how'd you feel? I was like, shocked. I think I was in a bit of shock.
Was there a terrifying what do I wear moment? I mean, if somebody suddenly says you've got to go, or was that all sorted already?
My agent asked Chanel if they would dress me, and the UK were like, oh, sorry, we can't help. And then Jessica Hausner asked the Austrians, and they said yes.
Good for them. Chanel dressed me tonight.
The Austrian Chanel's dressed me.
And so I want to show another clip from Little Joe. I really, really, I think it's a great movie. This is a clip with you and your son in which he is sort of meeting the plant for the first time. We'll show this and we'll talk about this afterwards.
Okay. Here
we
go.
Look what I have for you.
Oh. Is that allowed? I mean,
no one has to know. Do you like it?
Yeah. It's really hot in here.
Yes. It needs to be warm. This is a very special breed. You have to take good care of it. Keep it warm. Talk to it.
Really?
It's a living being. It needs attention and affection.
What's so special about it?
It makes you happy. What do you say we call him Little Joe? Hi, Little Joe.
Hi, Little Joe.
Welcome.
I just love the fact that the whole tone of the film is kind of, it's like it's one inch away from bursting into shrieking, but it never quite does. It's such a strange experience watching it.
Yeah, Jessica was very, she knew exactly what she wanted the whole way through. But a funny little fact, coincidence, is that Kit Connor, who plays my son there, he plays the young Elton in Rocketman.
Oh, wow!
Yeah, so he was gracing both of the red carpets at Cannes. He was like, oh, just come off the Rocketman carpet. It's like 14. He's the most chilled.
So are you on the awards circuit now? I mean, is it... Because the film opens here in February, so it must be eligible for BAFTAs, because it's up until...
No.
Okay, fine. So you're not in the middle of all that sort of that of whirlwind nonsense.
I'm not sure. I don't know.
Okay, you try it as a can. That's fine. That's all anyone needs.
I know. Hopefully, I'll get a warning. But
Listen, I genuinely think it's brilliant, and I think I guarantee you that critics are going to have a really hard time writing about it. Not least because, as I think we're sort of demonstrating, you can't sum it up in a sentence. And also, what you don't want to do is give too much of it away. Yeah. What was the best review you read of it in Cannes?
You know what, admittedly, I don't want to disappoint you, but I didn't actually read any.
Do you stay away from reviews?
Not always. I think this film was tricky for me watching it the first time because Jessica's really wanted it very artificial at times. It's like the opposite is what you're told all the time. You encourage to be open and natural. And she wanted me to speak almost artificially at some points. So I found it quite strange to watch. I think it's obvious it's deliberately stylized, but no, I didn't. I haven't read any reviews, I'm sorry.
Okay, but so do you generally stay away from them, or...?
Not really. If someone said, oh, this is a really nice review, I'll read it. If, okay. if it's a terrible
Okay, so
review.
They get kind of filtered beforehand?
Maybe, yeah. Okay. I mean, I haven't had that much experience, really. I mean, I've only... This is my second lead in a feature film, so... not had, you know... millions of reviews to read.
You have a key role in Hail Caesar.
Yes, I do.
Tell us about working there. Well, tell us about what that was like, because I love that film and I love that scene.
Oh, yeah, it was such a fun scene to shoot. I think it was such a relatable scene, just being behind the scenes, shooting something of a set. It was really fun. They've got a really familial atmosphere on their sets because they use the same actors again and again and again, so it's really relaxed and... They're just like, oh, yeah, try this. So it was very playful atmosphere. And obviously Alden and Rafe are so natural. You don't really have to act. You just look at them and they're just brilliant.
Should we have a quick look at you not really acting in that case?
Yeah.
Marilyn, we dance. 27 Apple, take two. Action.
Oh, Monty, come join me on the divan. Seems Allegra's a no-show, which is simply a bore. But I'll partner you in bridge. Why the pout?
Would that it were so simple.
Cut. Very good. Very good.
I mean, was it fun to... Because that scene...
It was really fun.
Because that's the... that is the scene that everyone remembers from Hail Caesar.
Yeah, it's really fun. I'd like to do a whole film of that scene. I think. Playing actors who were really struggling and really bad as well, and also playing kind of... I think my character was supposed to intimidate him a bit, so she was not really having any of it and kind of a bit pissed off later on anyway. But so that was really enjoyable.
The thing I love is the word divan.
Divan, I know.
What is a divan?
A divan fabulous sofa, chaise lounge,
But it's the way you say, come, sit with me on the divan. And every time I hear that, that's not a word I'm familiar with. The Coens, the story is that they finish each other's sentences. Is that actually true?
I don't think so. I mean, they both had different approaches. So one was kind of... having a laugh and suggesting the funny things. And the other one was, I think he was looking at other things, really. But it was very relaxed. I think it was really obvious how we would play that scene because we're three actors and we're playing actors. And it wasn't the hardest.
But that's often the most difficult thing to do. Playing bad acting is really hard to do, isn't it? I mean, unless you are a bad actor.
Yeah. I don't know. It's probably quite cathartic, quite a release. My friend does a lot of comedy, and he says how he does it is he always thinks, and he's really funny, and he thinks, I'm just going to do what it would be to act it really badly. And that's how he does it. And he's hilarious. So.
So I looked at your sort of upcoming slate of stuff, and you're busy for the next 4 years. What have you got coming up?
I have a Netflix film called Outside the Wire, which is with Anthony Mackie and Damson Idris, who are both amazing. And it's set in the future, and it's about AIs fighting war, and inspired a bit by the pro-Ukrainian insurgency and pro-Russia insurgency, so it's quite interesting. And then Cruella, which is a Disney film, which is really fun.
What are you doing that?
I play a lovely lady called Catherine, and I really should ask them what I'm allowed to say, because people keep asking me, and that's all I've got to say.
Almost nothing, probably, but carry on, it's fine, you know.
Nothing. But it's really visual and bright, just like Hail Caesar. The costumes are incredible, and very, very Vivian Westwood-inspired thing they are. And then a film that's based on the true life of a man called David Tate, who, it's not very cheery, but he was abused as a child, and it's an amazing story. And he opened up, for the first time, it's actually on YouTube, actually, he opened up about his childhood abuse, sexual abuse, when he was on stage at an NSPCC event. And it's about his really difficult journey, and it's really moving. So I'm doing it with Mark Stanley, who's an up-and-coming actor, who's just so phenomenal, and I really hope that it gets the exposure, because Mark would totally be nominated for, I mean, he's amazing. Such a brilliant performance by him, anyway.
So basically, that's it. The next few years are completely planned.
Well,
out.
I don't know what I'm doing next year. It's just the same as Taryn, just reading things. And I think people say you're as defined by what you don't do as what you do do. Mm. And it's important to make that choice and choose something that you. So I'm waiting for the right thing.
What's the best thing you've turned down?
The best thing I've turned down. I don't know, I can't say that, can I?
You can, of course you can.
I don't know. I don't know. I shouldn't probably say that. Because someone else has played the role.
I know, that's kind of half the fun. Anyway, look, I think Little Joe is terrific. I really, really hope that it gets the attention that it deserves. As I said, even now, I'm getting in a cold sweat about having to write the review of it. Not because I don't want to, but because it is so complex to write about, except I think the thing we could, it's brilliant, it's really well directed, you are terrific in it, and it has a wonderful soundtrack. And I do think it's a movie that will really get under people's skin in lots of very, very
strange
ways.
Yeah, there was a bit
ways.
Of anger sometimes at Cannes. There were some really challenging questions, actually. It was kind of frightening.
Okay, but Cannes is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, Cannes is the place that people get.
It brought up some real political topics, which we really weren't expecting.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Well done for not going down the Lars von Trier route in that case.
I know.
So it comes out in February, and we look forward to all the other things, including finding out what it is that you're actually doing in Cruella.
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming on the
show. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Emily Beecham.
Thank you.
Thank you
Bye.
So much.
Thank you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Now, as you may know, one of my favourite films of the year, well, my favourite film of the year, as it turns out, is Bait. And Mark Jenkin was on the show a while ago, and last month we announced, and I believe we announced this exclusively, I hear that Mark announced it on the same evening, but 5 minutes after us, that there is going to be a screening of Bait here with a live score, which is going to be provided by Gwenno Saunders. And now Gwenno is an absolutely brilliant musician who I had first seen at the Boardmasters Festival in Cornwall. And you can hear some of her music on the soundtrack anyway. But essentially, when Mark was saying he was going to redo this, he said, I'm going to get in Gwenno to do a new soundtrack, to do it live. So I am thrilled that on this Christmas show, a musical element will be introduced to the show through the fabulous Gwenno Saunders. Please welcome her to the stage.
tell us about how you have done or how you're going to do the live score for Bait.
Well, Mark's original score was done using a small Korg Volca, which I suggested to him, actually.
All right.
So we were having
a ripping you off from a long...
Basically, no. But so we were having this sort of conversation about synths, and then... so I'm kind of along similar lines. It's a really... Because obviously I was a bit overwhelmed when I got asked to do it, because it's a lot of work. But the soundtrack is minimal, which I love for that reason. Yeah. So it'll be along similar lines, but what's been fun is doing the sort of the music that's on at the pub, so having to look through old records and then sort of find different songs for that. And I've written two or three songs. Also with me performing will be Georgia Ellery, who plays Katie in the film. She's studying jazz at Guildhall, and she's in a good few bands, and she plays amazing violin. So it'll be a bit sort of droney, sort of ambient violin, scratchy, electronic.
Just, it sounds brilliant, and it's here at the BFI that's happening.
Yeah.
And the date is
the 17th of January.
Fantastic. I honestly cannot recommend this highly enough. I imagine many of you have seen Bait, which is, as I said, as far as I'm concerned, the best film of 2019. And I'm a huge fan of it. And I'm a huge fan of your music as well. And I think the combination of those two things together is really exciting. Have you known Mark for a long time? How did you and he first meet?
Well, I was... I made a Cornish language album called Le Corve, which means the place of memory. Because I'm a first language Cornish speaker. I grew up speaking Cornish in Cardiff. I'm not Cornish by birth.
Did anyone understand you speaking Cornish in Cardiff?
Well, my dad did, because he's Cornish. So we spoke Cornish at home as well. They're very similar Brythonic language.
Your dad's a poet?
So my dad's a Cornish poet. And so I was looking for people to work with visually, and I found Mark's work through a production company called Golden Tree. Mm-hmm. And it was a project called Arvor, which means coast. And then I saw Dear Marianne, and he sent me Bronco's House.
Which is great.
Which was amazing. So aesthetically, I felt that we were sort of on similar pages, really. And it was just really exciting to find something so Cornish and so forward-looking and outward-looking and progressive as well, creatively. And that didn't work out. So, and then it's been quite nice in a way, because we didn't get to collaborate on my album, but I'm now doing another version of the soundtrack live. So,
do you think something special is happening in Cornwall at the moment?
Well, I was excited by it because I think linguistically things are happening. There's not a huge amount of Cornish speakers, for example, but I definitely, as an artist, reached a point where I felt very excited about writing a Cornish record. Because I felt that there would be somebody to hear it. Mm. And, you know, it's a Pandora's box of culture, Cornwall, which is not as well known. And I think that's what's made Bait so exciting as well, really, is that it's expressed a community and a place so directly that doesn't get a platform very often, and it's, I mean, even from a language point of view, I think it's interesting to hear the Cornish dialect and things like that, so it's not a familiar thing to people.
You talked about Mark's filmmaking in connection to the artwork of Peter Lanyon, and you've talked about him being painted. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, well, I was really inspired by Peter Lanyon when I was writing my album, who was this painter from St Ives. And again, Peter Lanyon's very abstract work, landscape work, is again, it's like the most Cornish thing I'd seen. Mm-hmm. But yet again, it didn't fit into perhaps more nostalgic feelings of what Cornwall's about.
Yeah.
And it's very direct again, and I think there is a directness in Cornish art, which really excites me. And turns out my dad's poetry books published by Clive Bootle in London, and all of the covers had Peter Lanyon paintings on them, right. And I hadn't even realised. So it's like there's a lot of these small connections that happened, and I wrote a song about Peter Lanyon then called Tir Hamor, which means land and sea, because he, to get a better view of the landscape, he took up gliding, and unfortunately had a gliding accident and passed away not long after that. So.
Have you always loved language? Has that always been a driving force?
I was raised by linguists. I was in an English pop band for a long time. I was in the Pipettes, so, and that couldn't be further away, really.
What did you do in the Pipettes?
I was one of the singers, and it's all languages. But I think the older that you get, and particularly as an artist, you sort of dig deeper and deeper, and you're looking for stuff that you know really, really well. And I made a Welsh language album, yeah. And then I
How
made.
How many languages do you speak?
Just three.
Three.
Yeah. But it's pretty common. It's like three languages across Europe, and yeah.
I speak one.
Yeah.
And I failed my French O level three times. And I finally got it on the fourth attempt because they wouldn't let me into college without a French O level. And the only reason I got it was because the vicar's wife was French and she tutored me and she taught me the phrase un chute de neige, which means a fall of snow, and it turned up in the write down what you see. And that's how I got my French O level.
Well done.
But that thing, yes, it is common across Europe, but it isn't that common in Britain.
We have our older languages and we also have our newer languages. There are 500 languages spoken in London, for example, community languages. Yeah. There's 100 in Cardiff. So it's quite a common thing. And I think the more you... I particularly through music, I love music that I don't necessarily understand the lyrics to. I think it creates space to escape, sort of psychologically. From my personal point of view, having Cornish is fantastic because there hasn't been a huge amount of original music over the past century.
Yeah.
Brenda Wootton is massive, part of that. But, there's not a huge amount. So it gives me a lot of space as an artist to write stuff. And I think it creates an intimacy as well because it's my first language.
Am I right in thinking that when Taron Egerton walked into the green room, you and he started speaking Welsh to each other?
I know, I do. He was Welsh. It's amazing. Yeah, so he's a fluent Welsh speaker. And it's so funny because when you meet people that haven't lived in Wales for a while, I said, oh, so are you speaking Welsh? He's like, oh, yeah, I'm not very confident. I haven't been speaking Welsh for a very long time. He said this all in fluent Welsh, by the way. So it's just,
But the thing that I was told, because Linda, my wife, is here, her family is from Wales, and the thing that I was told was that because they've taught the younger generation to speak Welsh, that there is now this thing that kids can speak Welsh, but their parents can't. So kids can have conversations with each other around the parents, but not only can the parents not understand, but the parents are annoyed because they know they should understand it, but they don't. So it's become the kind of the language of subversion,
yeah,
which is
definitely
great.
Yeah, because there are more and more Welsh schools and stuff opening up. But
do you think the Cornish language will...
It's amazing that it's here still,
all.
It hasn't had a huge amount of funding or support, really. I hope so. Why not? It's a brilliant language. And I think that every language has its history, the people that have spoken it, and obviously until 17th century, people in Cornwall didn't speak English. So, it's definitely, it reveals something about the history of Britain, that perhaps is worth remembering and engaging with. So,
you don't speak Manx, do you?
I don't speak any of the Gaedic languages, unfortunately.
My family's from the Isle of Man, but none of them.
Oh,
no way. Cool. But none of them, because they're the last natural Manx-speaking person.
Is that on the up as well? Yeah.
Very slowly.
Yeah.
I think they're up to three now.
No, not at all. No, they're doing really well. Yeah.
Four. it's a very small island. Listen, so the live music for Bait is here on the 17th.
Yeah.
And tickets will be available from the BFI box office. Do come along. I'm definitely coming along. It's going to be a really great evening. Thank you so much. And thanks for coming along and playing that beautiful song on the piano.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see what you do with the live score for Bait. Ladies and gentlemen, the fabulous Gueno.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you. That was great. Thank you. If you want to hear proper Christmas music, we put together a top... Well, we started out doing a top 10, and then Nick, who, as I said, has been building his part up, said, let's do a top 12 of music from Christmas movies, or Christmas music from movies. So we've got this Listomania, and it's, you know, it's about sort of 10 minutes of music, but we all like the music. So here we go. Here is the Listomania, in no particular order except for the one that's at number one, of a rundown of the 12 pieces of Christmas music from the movies that Nick and I decided would work the last time we looked. Okay, so have I got the list here? I have, yes. Oh, yeah. All right, at number 12, this is a bit of an oddity. This is from an animation from 1964, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, stop-motion animation. This is very cute. You probably won't have seen this.
Well, folks, as for the rest of the story...
He went down in history.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose. And if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows.
We wanted to mix it up a little bit and not just have all the stuff that everyone would expect. Nick and I made a program for BBC Four, Secrets of Cinema. We did a Secrets of Cinema Christmas special, which incidentally they're repeating on the 23rd, a week today. And one of the first things we said was we have to have Tangerine in there, because Tangerine is a film that people don't automatically think of as a Christmas film, but it all takes place over Christmas Eve. Here is a musical interlude from the fabulous Tangerine. Entire film shot on a mobile phone. At number 10, something which needs no introduction at all. If you have tears, prepare to shed them.
We're walking in the air. We're floating in the moonlit sky. The people far below are sleeping as we fly.
At number 9, again, needs no introduction at all.
The neighbors might think, bad thing. Say, what's in this drink? I wish I knew how to break the spell.
I'll take your hand, your
That is one of Nick's favourite Christmas films, which is why we kind of include it. At number 8, this is interesting. Put this in because it's not a film that I love, although other people do, but it is a brilliant piece of music. This is Run, Rudolph, Run from Home Alone.
Out of all the reindeers, you know you're the mastermind. Run, run, Rudolph, Rudolph ain't too far behind.
Okay, now for the next one, it's a film that actually we put in the Secrets of Cinema Christmas special, and it turned out that many people hadn't seen it, which is a surprise because I thought it was kind of pretty popular. It's by Casey Lemons, who recently made Harriet, which is a terrific film currently playing in cinemas. This is from Black Nativity, and I think it's great. That is a film that doesn't get the love it deserves, and if you haven't seen it, do go and check it out. Now, for the next one, Taron Egerton said his favourite film probably of all time, Muppet Christmas Carol. I'm going to play you a song from Muppet Christmas Carol that isn't in all the versions. We're not going to play the whole thing. You know what it is? Oh, well, there we go. In that case, let's just go. I'm so pleased. That is the mark of a classy audience. What are we going to play? It's the bunny. Thank you very much.
There was a time when I was sure that you and I were truly one, that our future was forever and would never come undone, and we came so close to being close.
Can you believe the studio made them cut that out of some of the versions of the film, which is really shocking. Trivia question, what's the other song that they recorded that isn't in the film, that's actually the best song in the film? Room in Your Heart. See, none of you heard of it, right? Room in Your Heart is on the soundtrack album. It's actually the best song from Muppet Christmas Carol, and it's not in Muppet Christmas Carol. On to number 5. This is from Nightmare Before Christmas.
What's this?
The monsters are all missing, and the nightmares can't be found. And in their place, there seems to be good feeling all around. Instead of screams, I swear I can hear music in the air. The smell of cakes and pies are absolutely everywhere.
Pop quiz trivia question. What's the movie in which Bing Crosby sings White Christmas? Holiday Inn and... Here's both of them.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
Okay, into the top three, and it's tear-jerk-tastic. At number three, it's brief, but it's lovely.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right. Attaboy, Clarence.
Oh, Mary. You like me to lasso the moon for you, Mary?
It's uncanny, isn't it? It's like he's in the room. Into the top two. We argued about this. I lost. At two.
I feel it in my fingers.
In my fingers.
I feel it in my toes. Christmas is all around.
And finally, there really was no choice. At number one, the greatest Christmas song possible. And I'd just like to say that when you look at the tiny little girl to whom this song is sung, I've met her, and she's great.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight.
Judy Garland singing to Margaret O'Brien. So look, we're at the end of the show, and we said if we had time, we would end with a communal song, because I thought it'd be nice if we all sang something together. Unfortunately, there wasn't anybody up for playing anything other than me. So, firstly, I'd like to thank Nick for all the brilliant work with the stills. Heather for producing the show, and Eddie for being a constant support all the way through. And our guests tonight, Taryn Edgerton, Emily Beecham, and Gweno. So I'm going to ask you this, right? If I go over there, and believe me, my piano playing is really not great. If I play a song, a Christmas song, and we put the words up on the screen, will you join in? Yes. Should we do that again a little bit more enthusiastically? If I play a song and the words are on the screen, will you join in?
Yes.
Okay. Look, if Gweno could do this, I'm going to do it. Right, so we step over to my instrument. Key of F, all right, for everybody?
That's still on. All right. Is it there?
Now, you all know this song. It was immortalised by Elvis Presley.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll feel so blue just thinking all about you.
Well, there we go. That was the Christmas MK3D show, recorded live at the BFI South Bank in London. If you like the sound of that show and you'd like to come along, just go to the BFI website for tickets. Thanks for listening. Remember to tell your friends. And if you want a version of this podcast without adverts and access to some exclusive video extras, then why not check out our Patreon page? Tell your friends. Keep watching the skies.
Snowflakes start falling. That's when.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.